No, it's my pleasure to be here and to talk to you about embodiment and metaphorical imagination. I'm a cognitive scientist who does a lot of different things in cognitive science, but one of the fundamental beliefs I have about the way you can do cognitive science productively is that we can learn a great deal about the way that people think by closely examining the way that they speak and the way that they write. And I want to start off with an example of this by showing you an excerpt of a conversation between a psychotherapist named Judy and her client named Howard. Howard is a man in his late 30s. He had recently been laid off from his job. He had recently divorced. And he was having some troubles in life, and so he was talking to Judy about his problems. And so part of the conversation goes something like this, where Judy goes, the therapist, "When you have a problem, what do you do with it?" Howard says, "I usually let it be a problem. I don't usually do anything much." And then the therapist, Judy, goes, "Does the problem go away if you don't do anything about it?" "No, it gets worse, or it just complicates things as you go further down the road." Can you look at your own life, look down the road of that line, and see what that's going to do in your life? Look down the road. Yeah, kind of visualize what your life will be like. It will just continue the way it is. Kind of like a snowball effect? No. No, not a snowball. Just kind of floating down the river. What's it like to be floating down the river? Tell me more. It's comfortable. It's safe. Everything just keeps on an even keel, you know. You're just kind of floating. Kind of in a canoe going down the river, or no, more like a great old big barge on a great old big river. Barge, very stable, kind of. Yeah, plenty of room to spread out and sit in the sun, yeah, and you don't have to worry about falling off the edge. And sun, you know, it's kind of hazy. It's not really clear sun, it's kind of hazy. Kind of half asleep, that's what it's like. What happens when you kind of come to the falls that are down there about 2 miles down the river? Get the hell off the river. Well, that's certainly one way to handle it. Get out. I feel a lot of discomfort. That's what happened just last month. I hit those falls last month. Last time there was kind of an external situation that sort of forced you out of your boat. Yeah, it was uncomfortable, but I was enjoying it too, and I didn't want to go back into just floating. It was uncomfortable, and I was out. I've been floating a long time. Well, you found that works for you in a sense. What works for me? Floating. Because I stay comfortable, and in a sense, but it may now be inappropriate. It may not be working as well as it did in the past. Yeah, I need a little excitement now and then. Some rapids, yeah, something I can keep control in and not drown. So there's nothing remarkably creatively poetic about Howard and Judy's discussion here, but what's interesting is that they co-construct a metaphorical understanding of Howard's life and his problems as being kind of life is like a journey. And the idea of life being like a journey is thought to be in the contemporary literature to be a kind of metaphorical thought or a conceptual metaphor by which we organize aspects of our lives, including things about thinking about our lives and relationships as being like kind of this journey thing. But what's interesting here about this particular conversation here is it isn't they're just thinking abstractly about, well, his life is a journey. It has all of these rich sensory details. So he thinks about his life as being floating, and it's floating on this river, on this barge, and it's lazy, and the sun's coming down. It's very sensuous. It's very embodied. And what I want to suggest to you today is that metaphorical thought is a big part of the way that we speak and understand things in the world. But our metaphorical thoughts are not abstract entities, but rather they arise through processes of simulating what it must be like to be in an experience. So that when Howard speaks about his life as being kind of like a journey, he's simulating for himself in the moment of talk what that must be like and reporting on that. And so that this discourse here reflects something about the importance of embodied imagination or, as I'm going to try and argue, embodied simulation in thought and language. Now the idea that there are these things called conceptual metaphors really became prominent in 1980 with the publication of a book by a linguist George Lakoff and a philosopher Mark Johnson called Metaphors We Live By. People for centuries and centuries have talked about metaphors being an important part of our lives. But the argument Lakoff and Johnson want to make is that metaphor is not just the type of language that's special and poetic, but it's fundamental to the way we think. And indeed, it's part of ordinary thought, particularly in the way that it helps us structure abstract kinds of concepts and thinking. And what was particularly influential about the work of Lakoff and Johnson is that they actually provided some kind of empirical ways of examining this idea, and not just philosophically speculating about it, but trying to provide linguistic evidence to support the idea that there are these things called conceptual metaphors that influence the way that we think and speak. So for example, one of the things that they did is to examine what are called the systematicity of conventional expressions. So consider expressions like we're headed in opposite directions, or we're spinning our wheels, or our relationship is at a crossroads, or our marriage is on the rocks. And these all seem like cliched slang expressions. Many people refer to these as dead metaphors. But in fact, according to this kind of a perspective, these and many other kinds of expressions like this are actually reflective of the idea that we're thinking of love relationship as being a journey, where the source domain of journey and our experiences of taking journeys is projected on to help better structure this more abstract idea of love relationships. And it has this embodied feel to it. I mean, I don't know, but I recently was divorced and I've done all these things. I haven't, these are not just expressions. I've lived all these things. It is metaphors we live by is really true. I've also had relationships where I've been swept off my feet and waves of passions have overcome me, and I was engulfed by joy or love, and I was deeply immersed in love. And in this case, you're thinking about love relationships as being something different, as a natural kind of force. And so one of the ideas that Lakoff and Johnson suggested is that some of our abstract concepts, or rather many of our abstract concepts, are structured by multiple kinds of these conceptual metaphors, where different kinds of source domains, often having a very embodied source to them, are used to help structure our abstract understanding of certain concepts. A important development in this work on conceptual metaphor comes from the work of Joe Grady, another cognitive linguist, and he suggested there's certain kinds of metaphors that are particularly important or primary because of the fact that they reflect these positive correlations in our embodied experience. So things that are big in our lives physically tend to be things that are important, and we use this to talk about things more abstractly. So we talk about tomorrow is a big day, reflecting the idea that tomorrow is an important day. More is correlated to some degree with things being up. Prices are high. Things that are close or things that are similar, those colors aren't the same, but they're close. Change is motion. My health has gone from bad to worse. Purposes are described as and thought of as destinations. He'll be successful, but he isn't there yet. We tend to think of abstract causes as being concrete physical forces, like they push the bill through Congress. And we tend to think of things like experiences of understanding as being things like physical actions of grasping, like I've never been able to grasp complex math. So this is actually an important discovery because of we see that these metaphors in speaking are reflective of these metaphors of thought. But what's underlying these kinds of metaphors of thought are these correlations in our embodied experience. And you can detect the possible presence of these by doing these kinds of linguistic analyses. Over the years, people in particularly the field of cognitive linguistics and psycholinguistics have provided a bunch of different kinds of empirical evidence to support this idea of conceptual metaphor theory, including, as I've just mentioned, things like systematicity amongst conventional expressions. They've also looked at more novel, creative kinds of metaphors, and one of the claims that certain people make is that a lot of these are not completely created in the moment out of nothing. They actually reflect creative instantiations of existing conceptual metaphors. So when I say to you that my marriage was a roller coaster ride from hell, that's a novel kind of expression, but it still is sort of a novel way of talking about the relationship being kind of like a journey, but it's a particular kind of journey here. So it's a novel instantiation of a conventional metaphor. People have done work on polysemy, that is words that have multiple related meanings. So you see people say things like, I finally see the point of your argument, where the scene is reflecting an understanding, and a lot of polysemy is motivated by these, again, kind of primary metaphors of understanding is seen as a kind of seeing. People have looked at historical semantic change to, so for example, show how words like see acquire their abstract metaphorical senses in historically regular patterns across a variety of different kinds of languages. One of the big movements nowadays in conceptual metaphor theory is work on non-linguistic communication. So a lot of gestures that we do are metaphorical, and that's another source of evidence to show that these are not just language-oriented, but they arise from patterns of thought, and the gestures reflect these patterns of thought. There's various people, particularly in Berkeley, George Lakoff and Jerry Feldman, who are doing these computational models, and there's a new theory of neural theory of metaphor, which tries to suggest that conceptual metaphors have some basis in various kinds of brain mappings. And there's various kinds of works that I in particular have done over the years in psycholinguistics to suggest that conceptual metaphors are things that people make use of when they're understanding various kinds of language. And let me give you just one example of this from a number of years ago. I was interested for a long time in people's understanding of metaphors like blow your stack, flip your lid, or hit the ceiling. Now, some of us might know these as referring to the idea of being angry. So I can say, I blew my stack, I flip your lid, or hit the ceiling. And these are not, again, these dead metaphorical expressions, but actually they're systematically related and motivated by the idea that anger as an emotion is understood by the source domain of heated fluid in the bodily container. So the more the bodily container fluid gets heated up, the angrier we get. At some point it gets too much and we explode, and we flip our lid, we blow our stack, we hit the ceiling, we get pissed off. That's where the word pissed, the expression pissed off comes from. The bodily fluid gets heated up too much, and all of a sudden you're pissing off, actually. That's where part of that where it comes from. And there's been linguistic analyses to show that, in fact, these kinds of idiomatic expressions are systematically motivated by these conceptual metaphors. But I, as a cognitive psychologist and psycholinguist, try to do experiments to show ordinary people do this. And so one set of studies, what I did is, like, I first of all asked people to come in and just simply talk about their embodied experiences of certain source domains in these conceptual metaphors. So in this one particular example, I was interested in imagining the embodied experience of being your body being like a sealed container with fluids. And then I asked them a series of questions, like what would cause the bodily container to explode? And people would say things like pressure. 92% of the people said some kind of internal pressure. When the bodily container explodes, does it happen accidentally or does it happen on purpose? And 88% of people say it happens just accidentally. It's not that you intentionally explode. It just happens without your volition. And when the container explodes and the bodily fluid come out, does the explosion happen in a gentle or violent manner? And this 94% said it happens in a violent manner. So people have these folk intuitions about these bodily source domains, so to speak. And if people understand idioms according to these conceptual metaphors, they should map their folk knowledge and their bodily experience of the source domain onto the concept of anger, and so that your concept of anger when you hear these expressions should reflect some of these kinds of embodied meanings. And the way that I tested that is in a number of experiments, but here's one example. I brought people into my laboratory and I had them read stories like, Sally was preparing for a big dinner party. She had to do a great deal of cooking. Her husband was supposed to help, but he was very late getting home from work. When her husband strolled in 10 minutes before the party, whistling and smiling, and then people either saw an idiomatic expression, Sally blew her stack, or they saw a kind of literal paraphrase of it, like Sally got very angry. And after that, they had to make a set of ratings on their agreement with the following three statements. Sally got very angry because she was under a great deal of pressure. And they had a rate on a scale of 1 to 7, with 7 saying they agree with that, 1 saying they're not agreeing with it, whether or not they think that's true. Sally got very angry without intending to do so, having to do with this notion of intentionality. And then Sally got very angry in a forceful manner, having to do with the manner of this particular kind of explosion. And the hypothesis was that if people are actually inferring all of this information as part of their understanding of the idioms, because of the motivating force of the conceptual metaphor, anger is heated fluid in the container, people should get significantly higher ratings of agreement to these three statements, having read the idiom as opposed to reading the literal paraphrase. The literal paraphrase is a more general kind of statement that doesn't necessarily entail any of these things. So let's see if in fact that's the case. And in fact, if you look at these mean ratings, we see that for the causation, the intentionality, and manner, people are giving higher, significantly higher ratings agreements having read the idioms as opposed to the literal paraphrases. And so what this suggests is that the metaphorical mappings between embodied source and target domains motivates the specific figurative meanings of many idioms. So when I say I blew my stack, you're going to infer not that just that I got angry, but that I got angry first because of internal pressure. You're going to infer that it was done unintentionally, and you're going to infer that the anger was exhibited in a probably violent kind of manner. You're not going to make that same kind of assumption for kind of literal paraphrases. So that we have complex meanings that we understand for these cliched so-called dead metaphors, but they're not dead metaphors. They're motivated by conceptual metaphors, so they have these rich meanings that we can kind of predict. And more generally, people have specific metaphorical conceptions of abstract ideas, like those referring to emotions, that are shaped by these recurring bodily experiences, like, for example, their experiences of their own bodily containers. Now, what I want to suggest to you is that traditionally in many areas of cognitive linguistics and to some degree cognitive science, when people say, okay, conceptual metaphors are an important part of what motivates how we speak and think. And the idea mostly is that when this happens is that people will see something like blow your stack, and that will activate in their head some little structure of knowledge like anger is heated fluid in the container, and then they'll use that to help them understand the meaning of the expression to blow your stack. But I wanted to suggest to you something, a different kind of orientation to this, to think about metaphor understanding in terms of embodied simulation. So conceptual metaphors, I want to argue, are not these static structures that are stored as lists in long-term memory apart from their embodied roots. But rather, people's understanding of verbal metaphors is not done just by activating a relevant conceptual metaphor. Rather, people's understanding various kinds of verbal metaphor, idioms, more conventional metaphorical expressions, novel expressions, involves an embodied simulation of what certain actions, including the source to target domain mappings, heated fluid in a container onto the idea of anger, must be or feel like. And the process of running these simulations and what they produce represents our understandings of metaphor, as well as all other kinds of language. Isn't this simulation account is not specific to metaphor, but to all of language, but I think it can be applied usefully to understanding the way metaphor works. So for, imagine the following expressions. This is a title from newspaper articles that I found in the internet. Pirate prodigy may grasp the concept of zero. There was this pirate that you may have famously, that many cognitive scientists have known about, that does these kinds of numerical abilities. The poor parrot recently died. But they had this thing, that this parrot may grasp the concept of zero, and another similar title was Journalists Who Grasp the Concept of Courage. Now, concepts of any sort, particularly zero and courage, are not things you can physically grasp. That's physically impossible to do. So why on earth do we talk about grasping these things? How can we talk about doing physical actions on an abstract kinds of ideas? And the idea, in my view, is that what happens is that we conceive of concepts, which are abstract entities, whether it's about zero or it's about courage, as physical objects. They have certain properties to them, and that once we are able to get a hold of these concepts physically, bring them into our possession, we can manipulate them, study them, understand them, so that when we say that we grasp the concept, we're grasping the physical object, therefore we are understanding the physical object. And what the embodied simulation is that you are imagining yourself grasping this thing. And you're doing a simulation of what that must be like. And this contributes to your understanding of what these particular metaphorical expressions mean. When I talk about an embodied simulation, again, I'm talking about a creation of what it might be like for others, such as a speaker or a writer who produces one of these expressions, to have the specific thoughts they do when they're communicating. And these imaginative simulations are mental actions where one is not doing one thing to stand for another, but where one mentally engages in actions similar to those that are being overtly referred to. Like you're mentally simulating what it must be like to physically grasp this object that is a concept. These simulation processes are not abstract. It isn't like I'm a weather forecaster that's simulating a weather front on the computer, which is a kind of simulation, but the simulations that I'm referring to have this more full-bodied feel to them. And the analogy that I like is one of being in an aircraft simulator, where you've been this big machine, where you're learning to fly a plane, and the sights in the environment are visual to you, and you can see them, and the plane moves as you're flying around. You're not actually flying a plane, but you're simulating what it's like to be so. And it has this full-bodied sense to it, full-bodied feel to it. And I think you're engaging in these kinds of full-body processes to some degree when you're using and understanding metaphorical language. And these simulations are imaginative acts that I think are not just done strategically. It isn't like, I think I'll run a simulation now to understand this. But this is a natural impulse or instinct as part of our cognitive being. They're done automatically and not just simply strategically. The idea of embodied simulation, I just take a sidestep here, is actually one that's having increasing importance in cognitive science. It's certainly big, particularly in the areas of certain work in cognitive neuroscience with the discovery of what are called mirror neurons, certain neurons in the premotor cortex, that what happens that when you see someone doing a particular action, your brain, your premotor cortex, fires up neurons as if you yourself are doing those actions. And there's some things that inhibit you from actually doing those actions, but your understanding, your perception of others is in fact partly done based on a simulation of yourself doing that through these mirror neurons. And mirror neurons are very popular and have been extended to talking about perception, people's interpretation of intentional actions, the ability to read other people's minds or thoughts. Is also an issue, not just simply to have a theory of another person's mind, but you can understand another person because you are imagining, you are simulating what it must be like for them. And that's how you understand other people's minds. Empathy is relevant to this. And various people in psycholinguistics have suggested that mirror neurons are activated when you hear certain kinds of language. So when you hear certain kinds of nouns, like hammer, you actually have some kind of action-oriented as if you were going to use the hammer. Certain kinds of verbs you hear certainly activate these mirror neurons as if you are engaged in the actions depicted by those verbs. So there's a lot of evidence, this is just a small part of it, where people are exploring the notion of embodied simulation that's within cognitive science. But I think embodied simulations are kind of cool, and I don't know why we don't talk more about this. And these other things called like fantasies and nightmares. Now, dunking a basketball, I used to be young, and I used to be, I am still the same size, but I used to be able, in a few days when the planets were aligned right, I used to be able to dunk a basketball. I can no longer do that. I'm too old. But I still have these fantasies of being able to do that, and I can feel what that's like. And I can't do it, but it's just me running these old simulations of what I think, I can do it, you know? So I watch basketball on TV and I see those guys, I can do it, because I feel myself doing it. I can't do it, but the simulations get me by. Skydiving is something I've never done. I will never skydive, because I've run enough embodied simulations of what that must be like. There's no way I would ever jump out of a plane, because I know what that feels like. Having sex. Fantasies. You know, these are full, these are not just little mental abstract routines you run in your head. When you're having sexual fantasies, this is the part where cognitive science needs to work on sexual fantasies. You know, these have a full body feel going on here. This is like all the stuff's going, it's good. This is what an embodied simulation is like. That's what fantasies are. So I think these things have a lot to do with many aspects of our life. But what's interesting is that a lot of people have been critical of the idea that simulation has anything to do with abstract concepts. You know, how can we simulate bodily abstract ideas and things that are impossible, like grasping concepts? And I think that metaphor provides an ideal case study to provide evidence to show that, in fact, we can simulate things that are more abstract and physically impossible to do. And so what I want to do now to sort of finish things off is to tell you about three very different kinds of experimental studies that I've done over the years using various different kinds of methods to provide evidence for this, or at least consistent with the idea that people are engaging in embodied simulations when they are engaging in metaphor use and understanding. The first one is a study looking at people's mental images for various kinds of expressions, like chew on the idea, swallow your pride, cough up a secret, break off the relationship, tear apart the argument. Very conventional kinds of expressions where the target here, I mean the object of being that's referred to is something that's abstract, but we talk about doing very concrete things with these abstract ideas because we are metaphorically thinking of ideas as objects, pride as the substance, secret as this thing, relationships as this unit, arguments as a thing that has a particular coherent structure that's physical. And you can do these various things. And so what I did in this particular study is I wanted to see if by asking people to imagine these events and asking them questions about it, can I get evidence of the fact that they're engaging in certain kinds of embodied simulation. So I had people presented them with either these kind of metaphors or these non-metaphorical comparisons like chew on the gum, swallow your pill, cough up blood, break off the branch, tear apart the sheet. And then in this study they had a hear the phrase, then they formed a mental image of doing this or engaging in this action for 10 seconds. And then I asked them a series of questions. And let me just show you part of the data from this. So one question I asked, what was particularly noticeable in your image that you had? And it turns out that people had roughly two different kinds of responses. One was where they made a specific reference to participating in the action. Like, for example, when presented with the thing, chew on the idea, one person said, well, what's noticeable is my jaw goes up and down as I chew. And it turns out that people give these kinds of responses significantly much more so than non-metaphors than for the metaphors. But for the metaphorical expressions, they do something different. They engage in kind of this conceptualized description of the action. So, for example, for the metaphorical expression stretch for understanding, a person said, what's noticeable about this image? There's much stretching going on, both in terms of the ideas being stretched out to see if they are true, and me stretching to better see or examine any idea. And people do this far more significantly for the metaphors than the non-metaphors. This, I think, is a piece of evidence of their engaging in a kind of embodied simulation, where they're imagining of the understanding is something that is physical that they can stretch out and look at, and they themselves have to stretch to perhaps get a hold of this thing. It's a perfect example, I think, of some idea that they are engaging in an embodied simulation. Another question I asked, why is the concept they're imagining sometimes associated with this action? So if we put your finger on the truth, why do we talk about putting your finger on things associated with truth? And once again, when asking this question, people had two different kinds of responses. Generally, one is a concrete explanation of the process of action. So if I put your finger on the truth, they say, well, because that's what you do in explaining what is true. Or for chewing the gum, that's what you do with the gum. And they tend to give these significantly much more so for the non-metaphors than the metaphors. But for the metaphors, they give these analogous conceptual kinds of explanations. For chewing on the idea, someone said, well, chewing is related to a slow methodological activity, and it could be related to turning something over in your mind to better understand it. I mean, there's the basic embodied simulation source of their understanding of this particular expression, and in fact, people give these kinds of explanations much more so for the metaphors than for the non-metaphors. So in general, I'm not arguing that people necessarily, every time they understand these expressions, go through these big imagistic things, but if you slow them down and tap into them, having them form these mental images and asking questions of a certain sort, you find evidence, I think, indirectly for these different kinds of simulation process. A different set of studies, which are using a very different methodology, looked at real and imagined movements and how this may facilitate your understanding of metaphors. Again, we have these expressions, chewing the idea, grasp the concept, stand up for justice, throw away friendship, tear apart an argument, stretch for understanding, push an issue. And what I'm interested in here is, well, if we suppose we have people do a bodily movement that's relevant, like grasp. Suppose I have people go do this before they hear grasp the concept. Does that facilitate their understanding of that expression? Most people would say, that shouldn't help at all. That should interfere with your understanding of the metaphorical idea, because what you want to do when you understand the metaphor is get beyond the literalness of it. And if you engage in this literal action, physical action, that should interfere. But according to the simulation account, actually moving the body in a relevant way should facilitate your engaging in this simulation process. So the way that I did this, this is with a former student of mine, Nicole Wilson. People did the following, an experiment. They came in and they watched a video where a person held up a icon, like for example of a star, and then they mimicked a swallowing action. They hold up an at sign and they coughed, they held up a dollar sign and they grasped, and they did a bunch of these icon action pairs. And people watched this video so that they could come and given the icon, they could do the relevant action as the person in the video did. So they knew which action went which particular icon. And then in the main experiment, they came in and they sat in front of a computer, and the following occurred. The computer flashed on a particular icon. The subject had to perform the relevant action, and this lasted 5 seconds, and then immediately they saw a phrase, and they had to make a judgment, just simply comprehend the phrase. Push this button as soon as you understood what this phrase means. And there were three conditions of interest here. There was a condition where the prime, that is the bodily movement, was consistent with the target. So they engaged in icon to swallow, then they saw swallow your pride. There was a condition where the prime was inconsistent with the target, where, for example, they grasped and then they saw swallow your pride. That's inconsistent. And then there was a case where there was no priming action and they just simply saw the phrase. And the idea is if the bodily action is relevant to your creation of this embodied simulation, people should be much faster comprehension times for this condition than for the baseline. And they may even be slower here than with the baseline condition or the neutral condition. And let me first show you these data from this experiment where they did the action, and what we find here, this is the amount of time in milliseconds, so 2,927 milliseconds. This is under 3 seconds, and this is the standard deviations of the reaction times here. So people take about 3 seconds to do this in the no prime, but they're much faster. They're significantly faster in the case with the prime, as the bodily action matches the utterance. And in fact, they're a little bit slower, not significantly slower for the mismatching case. So the data look good. Looks like the bodily action facilitates their construction of the simulation, which facilitates the speed with which they understand these metaphors. Now, one possibility here is that when people do an action like grasp, it actually just activates a lexical item for grasping. And so what this result in this experiment is nothing more than lexical priming. You do an action, it makes you think of a word, and that primes your understanding or seeing of the word grasp. There's no embodied simulation going on here at all. And to control for this, I did a separate study where we brought people in and they saw the original videotape of the actor making these actions. And they simply saw the actions, and they had to write down a word that described the action. And it turns out, for example, in the case like the verb swallow, people correctly guessed that the action that the actor was doing was swallow. And overall, across all the items, they did this 43% of the time. If you loosen the criteria to have any time of cases where they guessed the verb that was synonymous to swallow, they actually did this 60% of the time. So people do guess this a fair degree when they're given the choice. But what's interesting here is if you then go examine the correlation between the reading time and the correct guessing of the verbs, you would expect that if this thing was all due to this lexical priming, it should be the more you guess, the faster the reaction time. So it should be a negative correlation. But in fact, it's not only not negative, it's actually slightly positive. And this is the case both with the analysis done in the correct verb and is done with the synonymous verb. So I don't think it's the case that this is simply a result that's due to the fact that people do an action and they guess a lexical item. That may have some contribution, but that's certainly not explaining the result as given by this control study. And a second study, we were interested in is, well, what happens now instead of asking people to do an action, you give them a sign and they have to simply imagine doing the action. And there's a lot of interesting neuroscience evidence suggesting that people, when they imagine doing certain kinds of actions, it actually activates relevant brain areas to their actually doing the action. So there's an overlap between imagination and action. What happens if do we get the same kinds of effects if they just imagine doing the action? So in a second experiment, they did the same thing, came in, learned to do the actions in relation to the icons, but then during the experiment, they were told, when you see the icon, imagine yourself doing the relevant action. And what we find here, again, in this particular step, is the same set of results. The people took around 3 seconds. In the no prime condition, significantly less so in the matching case. And here now, we actually have a significant interference effect. So that doing an action that mismatches the metaphor that you see actually slows you down compared to the neutral condition. And once again, when you do this control study of looking at people's guessing of the correct verbs given the actions and the correlation, none of these are significantly negative correlations, so I don't think that's the case. So these results suggest that real and imagined action does facilitate your comprehension of metaphors, which according to most traditional theories should interfere with it. But if it doesn't interfere because it helps you engage in this process of embodied simulation of imagining what these actions must be like, even if they involve abstract entities for which you can't really do actions on physically in the real world. The last set of studies I want to tell you about are the ones you can do if you have tenure. Because these are the craziest set of studies I've ever done, and they've been hard to do, and I've been doing them for a long time, but I think they're kind of interesting. These are called walking the walk while thinking about the talk. Let's consider the following two stories which have metaphor in them. The first story we'll call a successful story. Imagine that you're a single person. A friend sets you up on a blind date. You really like this person, start dating frequently. Your relationship was moving along in a good direction. Classic simple phrase, we don't think anything about it, but it's a metaphorical idea of you're thinking of your relationship as moving along some path, and it's moving on a path towards a destination that you think is good. It's a good thing. Relationships are journeys. It's moving in a good place to a particular destination or goal. In the first story, but then it got even better. The relationship felt like it was the best you ever had. This continues to this day. No matter what happens, the two of you are quite happy. In the second story, it begins the same. Imagine you're a single person. A friend sets you up on a blind date. You really like this person and start dating frequently. Your relationship is moving along in a good direction. Everything's the same, but now things change. But then you experience some difficulties. The relationship did not feel the same as before. This lasted for some time. No matter how hard you two tried, the two of you are not getting along. The idea here, I think, is that if you're creating an embodied simulation of what's going on in these two relationships, there's a sense where, well, this relationship is going great. We're moving along fine in the first case, and it continues to go fine. But in the second case, you know, it goes, and then it doesn't seem to be going anywhere because it's not working. The simulation that you construct to understand this narrative is of a different sort. So I wanted to see if I can get evidence for this, but first of all, I wanted to see what kinds of intuitions people had about these different stories. So I asked them, in a first study, I presented both these stories to people, and then I had them choose one of them in response to the following questions. Like, which of these relationships progressed further? And people chose the successful one 90% of the time. Which relationship was going faster at the beginning? Well, at the beginning, they were both the same. In fact, there's no difference there. Which relationship is progressing faster at the end or present? Not surprisingly, 90% of the subjects picked the story that was successful. Which relationship progressed more in a straight line? Significantly more said the successful one. And which relationship were the individuals heading in the same direction? People vastly chose the successful one. Now, none of these inferences were spelled out in the story. These are all inferences that people made because of the fact they were thinking of the relationship as being kind of like a journey. And the answers to these questions fall out of that metaphorical understanding. Let's contrast all of this now with a case where we change the stories from being metaphorical to being less metaphorical. Instead of having your relationship was moving in a good direction, we had your relationship was very important to you. A more abstract, literal kind of expression. Did the same kind of study where I gave people both stories and then they had to answer questions, and the data now changed a little bit. In which relationship progressed further, there was still a significant one for significant advantage for the successful. No difference for relationship progressing faster. The results were attenuated about which relationship was going progressing faster at the present. So they were still picking successful, but not quite as much. Which relationship progressed along a straight line? They were equally divided. And which relationship are the individuals heading in the same direction? And there was a slight but significant tendency to pick the successful. So people still can kind of answer these questions metaphorically, even if they haven't heard a metaphorical expression. But their metaphorical understanding is attenuated significantly over when you give them the metaphorical expression. So here's the main experiment that I was interested in. I wanted to see if people, when they're understanding these stories, engage in these embodied simulations. And so the way that I did this is I went out to a field, an athletic field at UC Santa Cruz, and we just stopped people. And we asked them to volunteer in this two-minute psychology experiment where they stood at a particular spot, and 40 feet away was a tennis ball, a yellow tennis ball. And they stood there looking at this tennis ball, and I played to them an audio tape of one of these stories, one of the metaphorical ones, successful or not, or one of the non-metaphorical stories, successful or not. They listened to the story, and at the end of that, we put a blindfold over them, and their task was to think about the story and walk to the tennis ball. Go! And they just sort of stumble out there, and then they stop at some point. What we did was we had a stopwatch, and we measured how long they walked, and then we had a tape measure, and we looked at how long they walked. And we wanted to see if people engaged in different kinds of walking along a straight line patterns, given the metaphorical and the non-metaphorical, given the successful relationship versus the non-successful. And the idea is, in the successful one, if it was metaphorical, they're going to walk further and longer compared to the unsuccessful, and more so for the metaphorical than for the non-metaphorical. So here's some data. In this first condition, they listened to the story, they're blindfolded, they walked to the ball. And when they heard the successful metaphor, they walked on average 15.1 seconds. When they heard the unsuccessful metaphorical story, they walked 12.1 seconds. So they walked less time for the unsuccessful metaphor. Again, the relationship wasn't going as well. They slowed down and didn't walk as far, as long. You looked at the distance. This is a big effect here. They overshot the tennis ball by about 4 feet in the successful story, but they undershot the tennis ball by about a foot and a half in the unsuccessful story. So there's this big difference in terms of the distance. So they're doing something different in terms of their patterns of walking when they hear these successful and unsuccessful metaphorical stories. One possibility is that, well, gee whiz, maybe the successful stories just make them happier because it makes them feel good about relationships, or it reminds them of the fact that their relationship was good or something. So it puts them in a better mood. So I did this measure of mood, and actually, this is not significantly different. There's a huge variance here. The mood thing does not explain what's going on here. So it seemed like there's a kind of a real effect. In the second condition, in this case, I had them listen to the story, I blindfolded them, and then they had to imagine walking to a ball 40 feet away, and they were given a stopwatch, and they had a click when they thought they were there, mentally. So it's, again, this kind of imagination thing. And they typically underestimated how long they would do so, but still we find this significant effect that people are taking longer, imagination-wise, when they think of the successful metaphorical story than the unsuccessful one. And this, again, is not determined by mood. So what happens if we take the metaphor out of these stories, put the non-metaphors in? Do you still find these effects? And the answer is kind of no. No metaphor, no difference in terms of time, no difference in terms of distance, no difference in terms of mood. There is a kind of anomalous effect here that in this imagined case, the people are somewhat greater in imagining in the unsuccessful case than the successful case, and I'm not quite sure how to explain that. But in general, even in the imagined case, there's some evidence to suggest that people are imagining themselves engaging in these kinds of bodily kinds of processes. And finally, without giving you the data, I've replicated this stuff using two other kinds of sentences. One case, moving in a good direction, which is the relationships are journeys. And another case, I gave them, your relationship is building a solid foundation, which is another way of thinking metaphorically about relationships, which suggests the conceptual metaphor of relationships and manufactured objects. And it turns out you get these distance effects when you have this metaphor, but not this one, because it's not journey-like. Even though it's positive and successful, you have to have the right kind of embodied metaphor to engage in these embodied simulation kinds of processes. So this is interesting, crazy research, and I'm still pursuing aspects of this. But I think it's consistent with the idea that when you're understanding metaphorical narratives, part of what you're doing is imagining yourself being in the situation that's being depicted. Conclusion here. What I want to suggest generally is that metaphor understanding allows us to imaginatively project ourselves into other people's minds and worlds. And this imaginative engagement arises from metaphor understanding not as an after-the-fact reaction to metaphor. Like, it isn't as if we understand the metaphor and then we have these emotional reactions to it or have these bodily effects, but rather these emotional reactions, these bodily effects are there as part of your fundamental processes of understanding these expressions because you're engaged in an embodied simulation to understand them. People may create embodied simulations of speakers' messages that involves moment to moment what it must be like for this other person, for this situation, which makes use of their ongoing tactile kinesthetic experiences and things they've experienced in the past. And most importantly, these processes operate even when people encounter metaphorical languages that abstract or refers to actions that are physically impossible to perform. And this is, again, a very interesting and important finding because people think this simulation for physical kinds of language and literal kinds of language, they've been skeptical about whether or not this relates to concepts that are abstract or metaphor, and I think these kinds of studies suggest these simulation processes do occur. And I think the findings are congruent with a larger body of evidence in cognitive science showing that there are these complex interactions between perceptual and sensorimotor experience, various kinds of conceptual knowledge and language understanding. Brought back in all this work to this aphorism by the great American poet Wallace Stevens that I've been thinking about for almost 20 years now. And he once wrote that reality is a cliche from which we escape by metaphor. And to me, there's an incredible important paradox here. There is a sense in which metaphor, as an instance of language, as a kind of action, is something that indeed seems transcendent. It's beautiful, it's abstract, it takes us away from our ordinary, grounded bodily world. There's something special about poets, for example, who write metaphor that makes us feel differently about ourselves. It makes us feel like we're rising above ourselves in some way. But I think that's partly right, but at the same time, there's something paradoxically wrong about this, because given the work that I'm doing, I want to suggest to you that metaphor is actually a significant part of both mundane and creative reality, that is inescapable. Metaphor is not something that we abstract away from. Metaphor is the grounding in which we do many, many different kinds of thought, language, and actions in the world. And so in this sense, thought and language are inherently grounded in our embodied actions, in our imaginative powers to conceive of abstract ideas and events in bodily form. Thank you very much for your attention.